Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah. Standing there behind the counter, willing to help with all the problems that I encounter.
Kia ora, Louisa.
Kia ora, Karen.
It's Halloween.
Ooh.
Demons, death, witchcraft, horror stories. You know, those books which evoke that atmosphere and sense of dread that threaten our comfort levels. And being scared is exhilarating. Fear is the strongest emotion we have, so of course it's exhilarating.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm into that, but carry on.
As a kid, you didn't love the games where they scare you, people jump out at you, you know, the primeval desire for the strongest emotion.
No.
In my family, we had a game called Big Hand, which was, my father used to do this to us at bedtime, so we'd turn out all the lights and we'd be in bed and he would hold a flashlight pointed up to the ceiling and then he would slowly bring his hand down over the light of the flashlight in a claw shape so it would look like it was coming down over the ceiling and on the walls of the room, closing in on you. Magnified, so it took up the whole room like a cyclops hand was going to pick you up and eat you like the cyclops.
Could you sleep afterwards?
Well, I don't remember the sleeping afterwards. I remember lots of shrieking and laughing, and I'm sure my mother remembers. But anyway, the Cyclops, it was when I just said that, I was thinking, you know, horror stories go all the way back. So the Odyssey is 3,000 years old, and there's certainly horror stories in there. Besides the Cyclops, there's Circe turning Odysseus' men into swine, which is pretty horrible, and you think your crew is going to sail you away from the island, and you discover they've all turned into little swine rooting around your feet.
Mm-hmm. There's a reason why I haven't read all the Greek myths.
Well, yeah, exactly. So myths, that's a really good point. So, horror goes back through myths, through folklore, through folk tales, through fairy tales. So Hansel and Gretel is pretty horrible, and in the cage, and the witch is making Hansel put his finger out so that she can see if he's fattened up enough to eat him, and he's sticking out the bone of the kid that died before.
Yeah.
Which in some stories they changed to a chicken bone. So into more modern times, everybody has their favorite horror author. One that I still need to explore is H.P. Lovecraft, who came up with the famous line, "Horrors must be original." There's a biography written about him. I have not read his books, but I know that Michelle Welbeck wrote a biography about him called Against the World, Against Life. So just seeing that title made me think this is somebody who needs to be explored. And it describes him on the little blurb on the cover, it described him as a kindly misanthrope. And I was thinking, so this kind of reminds us all of Edward Gorey, if you're an Edward Gorey fan, another person I want to encourage everyone to look up if they haven't yet. So he's the writer-illustrator of modern times, of contemporary times, but it was a horror which was very Edwardian in style, and I think we'd call it, I'm going to invent a subgenre here called surreal horror. And he had these stories with names like, the Headless Bust that are already bringing us into that sort of Edgar Allan Poe territory. So Edgar Allan Poe, I always think of him as sort of the originator of the modern horror story. But there was a gothic genre before that that academically speaking is considered the start of the horror books. But I just find them, they're always usually quite costumey and a bit brittle, whereas Poe, goes right for the jugular. My favorite being The Cask of Amontillado, which I remember we had to read in intermediate school. The scary one where the man invites his enemy down into the catacombs and walls him up live, bricks and mortars him up live. I can see you're looking
That's thrilled.
I've got a face
for
over here.
For intermediate school, that's great.
Yeah. Well, they knew, like I said, it goes all the way back, primeval desire to get out of your comfort zone. The Pit and the Pendulum is probably the most famous one, so that's the man on the table with the pendulum with the knife blade swinging above him, but if he gets off the table, he's got a big pit around him. And then there's the Grand Dame. I want to put in a word for Shirley Jackson and Daphne du Maurier, my two favorite Grand Dame horror writers. So Shirley Jackson, who's the author of The Haunting of Hill House, that's now everybody's talking about because it's going to be on Netflix. And Daphne du Maurier, who, besides writing My Cousin Rachel, currently made into a film, also wrote some very chilling thriller horror stories, including one set in Venice, which was made into a great movie and is a great story, Don't Look Now, extremely terrifying city in the winter, Venice. And then in our day, of course, we have Stephen King and Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, who wrote a book, which I read and can recommend, 20th Century Ghosts, showing the family talent. And now we also have online communities, which are sort of like a flash fiction. Well, they are. They're a form of flash fiction, but they're horror stories in microfiction, and they're created online and commented on online and fan fiction online and edited online by according to people's comments. And the one that was pointed, that was recommended to me, is Creepypasta, scaring you since 2008 with paranormal stories and short horror microfiction. So,
how interesting. Have you got an example, dear?
Well, I have some examples of some titles that you might like because we don't have enough time to read any of them, but even though they're short. But so two of my favorite titles were Return Carts Here, and then another one, Late Night Pizza. And then you can look them up by category. So, for instance, there's a Strange and Unknown category, which is the one I'm going to start from today, because I'm going to use that to lead us into a special treat that we've got. So the Strange and Unknown speaks of the human condition by reminding us of how little we know and understand. And so we've got listeners, lucky listeners out there, a special treat for you today. So this is a story that is going to show us how you can be scary without relying on the supernatural, just looking at the natural, not supernatural, evil lurking within humankind. And we've got a Roald Dahl short story. So it's from his anthology Kiss Kiss. A lot of people don't know Roald Dahl wrote stories for adults. He did, very sinister ones. And this is The Landlady. And here's Louisa to take it away.
Thank you, Karen. Well, I don't know if it's a treat. Could be a trick. We'll leave it up to our listeners to decide, shall we? So here we go. For the rest of the show, we are listening to The Landlady by Roald Dahl. Billy had travelled down from London on a slow train with the change at Swindon on the way, and by the time he got to Bath it was about 9 o'clock in the evening and the moon was coming out of a clear starry sky over the houses opposite the station. But the air was deadly cold and the wind was like a flat blade of ice on his cheeks. "Excuse me," he said, "but is there a fairly cheap hotel not too far away from here?" "Try the Bell and Dragon," the porter answered, pointing down the road. "They might take you in. It's about a quarter of a mile along the other side of the road." Billy thanked him, picked up his suitcase, and set out to walk the quarter of a mile to the Bell and Dragon. He had never been to Bath before. He didn't know anyone who lived there, but Mr. Greenslade at the head office in London had told him it was a splendid city. "Find your own lodgings," he'd said, "and then go along and report to the branch manager as soon as you got yourself settled." Billy was 17 years old. He was wearing a new navy blue overcoat, a new brown trilby hat, and a new brown suit. And he was just feeling fine. He walked briskly down the street. He was trying to do everything briskly these days. Briskness, he decided, was the one common characteristic of all successful businessmen. The big shots up at head office were absolutely fantastically brisk all the time. They were truly amazing. There were no shops on this wide street that he was walking along, only a line of tall houses on each side, and all of them identical. They had porches and pillars, and four or five steps going up to their front doors. And it was obvious that once upon a time they had been very swanky residences. But now, even in the darkness, he could see that the paint was peeling from the woodwork on their doors and windows, and that the handsome wide facades were cracked and blotchy from neglect. Suddenly, in a downstairs window that was brilliantly illuminated by a street lamp, not 6 yards away, Billy caught sight of a sign printed, propped up against the glass in one of the upper panes. It said, "Bed and Breakfast." There was a vase of yellow chrysanthemums, tall and beautiful, standing just under the notice. He stopped walking. He moved a bit closer. Green curtains, some sort of velvety material, were hanging on either side of the window. The chrysanthemums looked wonderful beside them. He went right up and peered through the glass into the room. The first thing he saw was a bright fire burning in the hearth. On the carpet in front of the fire, a pretty little dachshund was curled up asleep with its nose tucked into its belly. The room itself, so far as he could see in the half-darkness, was filled with pleasant furniture. There was a baby grand piano and a big sofa and several plump armchairs. And in one corner, he spotted a large parrot in a cage. Animals were usually a good sign in a place like this, Billy told himself. And all in all, it looked to him as though it would be a pretty decent house to stay in. Certainly, it would be more comfortable than the Bell and Dragon. On the other hand, a pub would be more congenial than a boarding house. There would be beer and darts in the evenings and lots of people to talk to. And it would probably be a good bit cheaper too, he thought. He'd stayed a couple of nights at a pub once before and he liked it. He'd never stayed in any boarding houses, and to be perfectly honest, he was a tiny bit frightened of them. The name itself conjured up images of watery cabbage, rapacious landladies, and a powerful smell of kippers in the living room. After dithering about like this in the cold for 2 or 3 minutes, Billy decided he would walk on and take a look at the Bell and Dragon before making up his mind. He turned to go, and now a really queer thing happened to him. He was in the act of stepping back and turning away from the window when all at once his eye was caught and held in the most peculiar manner by the small notice. Bed and breakfast, it said. Bed and breakfast. Bed and breakfast. Bed and breakfast. Each word was like a large black eye staring at him through the glass, holding him, compelling him, forcing him to stay where he was and not to walk away from that house. And the next thing he knew, he was actually moving across from the window to the front door of the house, climbing the steps that led up to it and reaching for the bell. He pressed the bell. Far away in a back room, he heard it ringing. And then at once, it must have been at once, because he hadn't even had time to take his finger off the bell, the door swung open and a woman was standing there. Now, normally you ring the bell and you have at least half a minute wait before the door opens. But this dame was like a jack-in-the-box. He pressed the bell and out she popped. It made him jump. She was about 45 or 50 years old, and the moment she saw him, she gave him a warm, welcoming smile. "Please come in," she said pleasantly. She stepped aside, holding the door wide open, and Billy found himself automatically starting forward into the house. The compulsion, or more accurately, the desire to follow after her into that house, was extraordinarily strong. "I saw the notice in the window," he said, holding himself back. "Yes, I know. I was wondering about a room." "It's all ready for you, my dear," she said. She had a round pink face and very gentle blue eyes. "I was on my way to the Bell and Dragon," Billy told her, "but the notice in your window, it just happened to catch my eye." "My dear boy," she said, "why don't you come in out of the cold? How much do you charge?" 5 and 6 pence a night, including breakfast." It was fantastically cheap. It was less than half of what he'd been willing to pay. "If that is too much," she added, "then perhaps I can reduce it just a tiny bit. Do you desire an egg for breakfast? Eggs are expensive at the moment. It would be 6 pence less without the egg." 5 and 6 pence is fine," he answered. "I should like very much to stay here." "I knew you would. Do come in." She seemed terribly nice. She looked exactly like the mother of one's best school friend welcoming one into the house to stay for the Christmas holidays. Billy took off his hat and stepped over the threshold. "Just hang it there," she said, "and let me help you with your coat." There were no other hats or coats in the hall. There were no umbrellas, no walking sticks, nothing. "We have it all to ourselves," she said, smiling at him over her shoulder as she led him upstairs. "You see, it isn't very often I have the pleasure of taking a visitor into my little nest." The old girl was slightly dotty, Billy thought to himself. But at 5 and 6 pence a night, who gives a damn about that? I should have thought you'd be simply swamped with applicants," he said politely. "Oh, I am, my dear, I am. But the trouble is that I'm inclined to be just a teeny-weeny bit choosy and particular, if you see what I mean." "Ah, yes. But I'm always ready. Everything is always ready, day and night, in this house, just on the off chance that an acceptable young gentleman will come along. And it is such a pleasure, my dear, such a great pleasure, when now and again I open the door and I see someone standing there who is just exactly right." She was halfway up the stairs and she paused one hand on the stair rail, turning her head and smiling down at him with pale lips. "Like you," she added. And her blue eyes travelled slowly all the way down Billy's body, to his feet, and then up again. On the first floor landing, she said to him, "This is my floor." Then they climbed to the second flight. "And this one is all yours," she said. "Here's your room. I do hope you like it." She took him into the small but charming front bedroom. Switching on the light, she went in. "The morning sun comes right in the window, Mr. Perkins. It is Mr. Perkins, isn't it?" "No," he said, "it's Weaver." "Mr. Weaver, how nice. I've put a water bottle in your sheets to air them out." "Mr. Weaver, it's such a comfort to have a hot water bottle in a strange bed with clean sheets, don't you agree? And you may light the gas fire at any time you feel chilly." "Thank you," said Billy. "Thank you ever so much." He noticed that the bedspread had been taken off the bed and that the bedclothes had been neatly turned back to one side, all ready for someone to get in. "I'm so glad you appeared," she said, looking earnestly at his face. "I was beginning to get worried." "That's all right," Billy answered brightly. "You mustn't worry about me." He put his suitcase on the chair and started to open it. "And what about supper, my dear? Did you manage to get anything to eat before you came here?" "Oh, I'm not a bit hungry, thank you," he said. "I think I'll just go to bed as soon as possible because tomorrow I have to get up rather early and report to the office." "Oh, very well then. I'll leave you now so you can unpack. But before you go to bed, would you be kind enough to pop down into the sitting room on the ground floor and sign the book? Everyone has to do that because it's the law of the land and we don't want to go breaking any laws at this stage in the proceedings, do we?" She gave him a little wave of the hand and went quickly out the room and closed the door. Now, the fact that his landlady appeared to be slightly off her rocker didn't worry Billy in the least. After all, she was not only harmless, there was no question about that, but she was also quite obviously a kind and generous soul. He guessed that she had probably lost a son in the war or something like that, and she'd never got over it. So a few minutes later, after unpacking his suitcase and washing his hands, he trotted downstairs to the ground floor and entered the living room. His landlady wasn't there, but the fire was glowing in the hearth, and the little dachshund was still sleeping in front of it. The room was wonderfully warm and cosy. "I'm a lucky fellow," he thought, rubbing his hands. "This is a bit of all right." He found the guest book lying open on the piano, so he took out his pen and wrote down its name and address. There were only two other entries above his on the page, and as one always does with guest books, he started to read them. One was a Christopher Mulholland from Cardiff. The other was Gregory L. Temple from Bristol. "That's funny," he thought. "Christopher Mulholland, that rings a bell. Now where on earth had he heard that rather unusual name before? Was he a boy at school? No. Was it one of his sister's numerous young men? Perhaps. Or a friend of his father's? No, it wasn't any of those." He glanced down at the book. "Christopher Mulholland, 231 Cathedral Road, Cardiff. Gregory L. Temple, 27 Sycamore Drive, Bristol." As a matter of fact, now he came to think of it, he wasn't at all sure that the second name didn't have almost as much of a familiar ring about it as the first. "Gregory Temple," he said out loud, searching his memory. "Christopher Mulholland." "Such charming boys," a voice behind him answered, and he turned and saw his landlady sailing into the room with a large silver tea tray in her hands. She was holding it well out in front of her and rather high up, as though the tray were a pair of reins on a frisky horse. "They sound somehow familiar," he said. They do. How interesting. I'm almost positive I've heard those names before somewhere. Isn't that queer? Maybe it was in the newspapers. They weren't famous in any way, were they? I mean, famous cricketers, footballers, something like that. Famous, she said, settling the tea tray down on the low table in front of the sofa. Oh, no, I don't think they were famous, but they were extraordinarily handsome. Both of them, I can promise you that. They were tall and young and handsome, my dear, just exactly like you. Once more, Billy glanced down at the book. Look here, he said, noticing the dates. The last entry is over 2 years ago. Is it? Yes, indeed. And Christopher Mulholland's is nearly a year before that. More than 3 years ago. Dear me, she said, shaking her head and heaving a dainty little sigh. I would never have thought that. How time flies away from all of us, doesn't it, Mr. Wilkins? It's Weaver, Billy said. Weaver. Oh, of course it is, she cried, sitting down on the sofa. How silly of me. I do apologise. In one ear and out the other. That's me, Mr. Weaver. You know something, said Billy? Something that's really quite extraordinary about all this. No, I don't, dear. Well, you see, both these names here, Mulholland and Temple, I not only seem to remember each of them separately, so to speak, but somehow or other, in some peculiar way, they both appear to be sort of connected together as well, as though they were both famous for some sort of same thing, if you see what I mean. You know, like Dempsey and Tunney, for example, or Churchill and Roosevelt. How amusing, she said. But come over here now, dear, and sit beside me on the sofa and I'll give you a nice cup of tea and a ginger biscuit before you go to bed. Oh, you really shouldn't bother, Billy said. I didn't mean you to do anything like that. He stood by the piano watching her as she fussed about with the cups and saucers. He noticed that she had small, white, quickly moving hands and red fingernails. I'm almost positive it was in the newspapers I saw them, Billy said. I'll think of it in a moment. I'm sure I will. There was nothing more tantalizing than a thing like this which lingers just outside the borders of one's memory. He hated to give up. Now wait a minute, he said. Wait just a minute. Mulholland. Christopher Mulholland. Wasn't that the name of the Eton schoolboy who was on a walking tour through the West Country? And then all of a sudden... Milk, she said. And sugar. Yes, please. And then all of a sudden, Eton schoolboy, she said. Oh, no. No, my dear, that can't possibly be right because my Mr. Mulholland was certainly not an Eton schoolboy when he came to me. He was a Cambridge undergraduate. Come over here now and sit next to me. Warm yourself in front of this lovely fire. Come on, your tea's all ready for you. She patted the empty place beside her on the sofa and she sat there smiling at Billy, waiting for him to come over. He crossed the room slowly and sat down on the edge of the sofa. She placed his teacup on the table in front of him. There we are, she said. How nice and cozy this is, isn't it? Billy started sipping his tea. She did the same. For half a minute or so, neither of them spoke. Billy knew that she was looking at him. Her body was half turned towards him and he could feel her eyes resting on his face, watching him over the rim of her teacup. Now and again, he caught a whiff of a peculiar smell that seemed to emanate directly from her person. It was not in the least unpleasant and it reminded him, well, he wasn't quite sure what it reminded him of. Pickled walnuts, new leather, or was it the corridors of a hospital? Mr. Mulholland was a great one for his tea, she said at length. Never in my life have I seen anyone drink as much tea as dear sweet Mr. Mulholland. I suppose he left fairly recently, Billy said. He was still puzzling his head about the two names. He was positive now he had seen them in the newspapers, in the headlines. Left, she said, arching her eyebrows. But my dear boy, he never left. He's still here. Mr. Temple is also here. They're on the third floor. Both of them, together. Billy set down his cup slowly on the table and stared at his landlady. She smiled back at him. And then she put on one of her white hands and patted him comfortingly on the knee. How old are you, my dear? She asked. 17. 17, she cried. Oh, that's a perfect age. Mr. Mulholland was also 17, but I think he was a trifle shorter than you. In fact, I'm sure he was, and his teeth weren't quite so white. You have the most beautiful teeth, Mr. Weaver. Did you know that? They're not as good as they are as they look, said Billy. They've got simply masses of fillings at the back of them. Mr. Temple, of course, was a little older, she said, ignoring his remark. He was actually 28, and yet I never would have guessed if he hadn't have told me. Never in my whole life. There wasn't a blemish on his body. A what? Billy said. His skin was just like a baby's. There was a pause. Billy picked up his teacup and took another sip of his tea. Then he set it down again gently in the saucer. He waited for her to say something else, but she seemed to have lapsed into another of her silences. He sat there staring ahead of him into the far corner of the room, biting his lower lip. That parrot, he said at last. You know something? It had me completely fooled when I saw it through the window from the street. I could have sworn it was alive. Alas, no longer. It's most terribly clever, the way it's been done, he said. It doesn't look in the least like it's dead. Who did it? I did. You did? Of course, she said. And have you met my little Basil as well? She nodded towards the dachshund, curled up so comfortably in front of the fire. Billy looked at it, and suddenly he realized that this animal had all the time been just as silent and motionless as the parrot. He put out a hand and touched it gently on the top of its back. The back was hard and cold, and when he pushed the hair to one side with his fingers, he could see the skin underneath, greyish, black, and dry, and perfectly preserved. Good gracious me, he said. How absolutely fascinating. He turned away from the dog and stared with deep admiration at the little woman sitting beside him on the sofa. It must be awfully difficult to do a thing like that. Not at least, she said. I stuff all my little pets myself when they pass away. Will you have another cup of tea? No, no thank you, said Billy. The tea tasted faintly of bitter almonds, and he didn't much care for it. You did sign the book, didn't you? Oh, yes. That's good, because later on, if I happen to forget what you were called, then I can always come down here and look it up. I still do that almost every day for Mr. Mulholland and Mr. Temple, Billy said. Gregory Temple. Excuse my asking, but haven't there been any other guests here except them in the last 2 or 3 years? Holding her teacup high in one hand, inclining her head slightly to the left, she looked up at him out of the corner of her eyes. She gave him another gentle little smile. No, my dear, she said. Only you.
Well, not looking good for Billy, is it?
No, not at all. And I just want to thank our technician, Richard, here, who's going to have to edit out your laughter, Karen, that I could hear. Sinister laughter it was, too. I could hear while I was reading.
Well, Roald Dahl never misses the mark with me. So now Richard is going to use his supernatural powers to create us another great show. And I'm just going to take advantage of this second that we have left to let everyone know that, remember, if you want to give us feedback on our shows, visit the Auckland Libraries website, www.aucklandlibraries.govt.nz, and leave a comment on the Auckland Libraries blog.
Well said, Karen. So now it's time for us to pop in our broomsticks and fly away.
Have we got a sound effect for sounds of brooms taking off?
Which is
cackle.
Cacitiano.
Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and
Catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day.